supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Goes back to the age of the dinosaurs, and it probably gave them spielkes then, too. We'll tell you what to do about this ancient invader later on in the show. In the meantime, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. How are you today?
I am excellent, Bob. Thank you, sir. Where are you?
I am in Santa Barbara, California.
Oh, where they got us on so early Saturday morning. I think it's still technically Friday, right?
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Bob from sunny Santa Barbara?
I have a patch of ground in my front yard, kind of an average size front yard, that sees a lot of shade during the year. It's on the north side of my house, but most importantly, it is underneath about a 70-foot Deodara cedar tree.
Oh, nice.
And my question is, right now, we've had a lawn there that I sheet mulched a few years ago, and I've kind of used it as a blank canvas, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Planted crimson clover and then some edibles, and I don't want to take anything away from the well-established cedar tree that's there, but I would like to grow something there. So I'm looking for specifically what would be an idea for a nice ground cover, shade-tolerant, north-facing patch of ground.
Well, first you have to tell me what you were able to grow that you could eat in dark shade-facing north.
We grew some kale with a little bit of success. I have I think it's a Peruvian tree spinach that...
Oh, I know that. Yeah, sure. The summer spinach substitute, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess the thing about that is it's toxic when raw, so you got to cook it. Thankfully, someone told us that before we grew it.
Good deal.
Yeah, and then, you know, just some cover crops. I've done buckwheat, I've done crimson clover, and, you know, I just recently mulched it, and it looks nice. I just am curious if you have any suggestions on a shade-tolerant, you know, perennial or even an annual that won't take too much nutrients or water away from the cedar.
Well, that's going to work in the reverse. A 70-foot tree is going to be a big bully that's going to take any water or nutrients from the immediate area. That's why it's so difficult to grow grass often in the drip line of a tree, even if there's no shade involved. Those roots, especially in a dry climate like yours, are hogging all the moisture. Plus, it sounds like you have an incredible specimen of a fabulous evergreen tree, and you are risking harming it by constantly digging around the root system. I think you are taking very foolish risks for absolutely no good reason. If you look in nature, for instance, the area underneath the tree is always barren or always naturally mulched with old leaves or whatever, but that tree sounds like it really does cry out to, look at me, look at how cool I am.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think it needs lipstick and high heels down low.
Okay.
But if you're going to insist, what I would suggest would be a sane compromise would be find some little cool planters that you could arrange perhaps in a circle around the, you know, maybe a couple feet away from the trunk of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And if the area is really shady, where you live in Santa Barbara, you can install shade-loving impatiens and begonias, and they would perennialize for you. They would not die over your winter. I mean, you might have to protect them on the two cool nights, the two cold nights you get a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I perennialize mine by bringing them in over the winter. They would look sensational, and they, although technically they're considered annual flowers where you are, they would perennialize and put on a good show. But I would like to end the digging and the disturbance mm-hmm. around the root system of this beautiful old giant.
Perfect. Thank you very much. That's great advice.
All right. Good luck, Bob.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sharon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am fine today, Sharon. How are you?
I'm just great.
And where is Sharon just great?
Well, I am just great in the lovely neighborhood of Mount Airy in Philadelphia.
Right out in the Chestnut Hill area.
Well, Upper Germantown.
Upper Germantown. Oh, right. Aren't we the special one now?
Well, Mike, I'm a first-time vegetable gardener here in my yard, and I'm having just a great season. I've got some gorgeous Cherokee purple tomatoes that are ripe and some eggplants and lots of greens. But my question is that a friend told me that I should not pick vegetables. I shouldn't harvest anything when stuff is wet, so like when it's raining or right after a rain. So what's the story on that?
Your friend has a very good point. That was good basic advice, and I'm so glad you called, because this is a little corner of gardening not a lot of people are aware of, but it's important for gardeners to know. So here's the deal. Technically, if you want an overall rule, don't handle plant leaves when the leaves are wet. If you could, using a pair of pruners and your God-given hands, reach into a tomato plant and get a Cherokee purple without touching leaves while they're wet, that would actually be okay. But plants that are prone to disease and certain other plants are very sensitive to being worked when their leaves are wet. For instance, tomato plants being prone to every disease known to man, God, bird, and plant, can get really pissy if you handle them while the plants are wet. String beans, which are not known for being prone to disease, if you pick the string beans while the plants are wet and you impact the leaves, the odds are that those leaves are going to be dead by the middle of the afternoon.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very weird phenomena. And fruit trees are so sensitive, I don't even like to look at my wife's peaches when they're still wet after a rain. I just stand outside and, like, blow into them to try to dry them off. Whereby raspberries I've picked in the rain, some other things, you know, going out and harvesting lettuce in the rain, I don't think that that would be an issue. And one of the conundrums we get into is virtually everything we grow in the garden is going to taste best when picked early in the morning.
Right.
But almost every morning, your bean plants are wet with morning dew.
Right.
And a lot of people who are picking their string beans at absolute the right time of day to concentrate the sugars to get the best taste end up wondering what ate their bean plants. It really looks afterwards. If do that for a couple days in a row, and it'll look like slugs have had a toga party out there. So it really is good to avoid, in general, the leaves of virtually all your edible plants when they're wet. Squash plants are somewhat sensitive. Tomato plants are. In this case, bean plants are the real drama queens, and I'm not really sure what the rhyme or reason with that is. Same thing with fruit trees. You should never work fruit trees when they're wet. So
okay.
Your friend is largely correct. There are some plants that it's probably not going to matter much. But if what you take away from this is never to go near string beans, for instance, when the leaves are wet, you will gain a lot more growing time out of the season.
And it doesn't matter if you're wearing gloves. It's not your hands.
Correct.
It's just disturbing the leaves.
Yeah. And it's a phenomenon that I admit I understand poorly. But I know it theoretically, and unfortunately, I've seen it happen in reality. And a lot of times when I was doing it, I knew better. I wanted the string beans, and trying to be careful, going out there with scissors, trying not to touch any leaves, but no. You're leaving the store, and the store detective has his hand on your collar. You think you were so clever, you know.
All right.
You go out at the end of the day, and they had ceased to be bean plants. They were former bean plants. They had joined the choir invisibule. But the corollary is, the stuff is going to taste best when picked early in the morning. Never right. pick in the heat of the day, because the sugars have like gone into hiding.
Okay.
So you're really looking for that morning where the plants aren't really wet. And I wouldn't worry too much about the other ones. But the bean plants, I would wait till 10 or 11 o'clock, even if it was starting to get a little hot out. I'd want them to be completely dry.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
And your friend was right to advise you so.
Okay.
All right,
Sharon? I'll let her know. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Very good. Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and invite all of you to check out our brand new Facebook page. You'll find a super quick little question of the day answered by me. Yes, every day. And I hope you'll add photos and stories about what you're growing in your organic garden. Maybe you'll even like us. Maybe really, really like us. But don't go doing your band imitation of Sally Field at the Oscars just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone call and details on the ancient weed known as horsetail. I'm Ancient Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is having an open house at their historic Ford Hook Farm headquarters in Doylestown on August 24th and 25th, featuring garden tours, guest lectures, and tomato tastings. Details at burpee.com.
It's 11:18 on WHYY, 84 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia. Partly sunny for now, becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms for this afternoon. Headed to a high of 92 degrees. For tonight, more showers are likely, cooling to 72 overnight. And for tomorrow, Sunday, partly sunny, humid with highs near 88. This is WHYY.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Melanoma is the deadliest skin cancer, taking the life of one person every hour in America. You can protect yourself this summer by using sunscreen and limiting your time in the sun. Scientists at Wistar's Melanoma Research Center are committed to understanding the causes and developing effective treatment for melanoma and better ways to prevent it. The Wistar Institute. Today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures. Online at wistar.org.
Hard work is at the heart of our national identity, but have Americans lost their drive?
Certainly immigrants are among the hardest workers. They get the ethic from coming from a country where you don't have a big, fat government safety net. You either work or you don't have food.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, working hard or hardly working. That's next time on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m.
This afternoon at 3 on WHYY.
The WHYY Young Journalists Summer Camp provides hands-on multimedia journalism experience for teens. You can register for the August session at whyy.org/camps.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, horsetail. It contains so much silica, you can use it to scrub out a damaged bird bath or clean up your scattered pots and pans. It was around in the age of dinosaurs, and it gives people spielkes today. We'll talk about this ancient and annoying weed after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good, Dan. How are you?
Not bad.
And where is Dan not bad?
Waterbury, Connecticut.
Oh, very good. Very good. I know that town. What can we do you for, sir?
About 3 years ago, I put 5 blueberry bushes along the side of my yard.
Okay.
As far as I know, when I did it, I did it properly. The whole area that these blueberry bushes are in is the whole bed is acidic. I have rose bushes. I have holly bushes.
Okay. No. Why is the bed acidic? What did you do to make it acidic?
Just peat moss.
Right. Okay. Roses are not an acid-loving plant, so I don't know where you were going with that. Generally, okay. Blueberries crave so acidic a soil that we grow them in a dedicated area where we can keep the acid levels of the soil so low that other plants would die off. Do you have your blueberries growing with other plants?
Yes, I do. All the blueberry plants are in a row, and there's rose bushes to each side of them.
Okay. And are the blueberries doing well?
No, that's a problem. They've been in the ground for 3 years, and what's happening is they're branching off into, like, not even a quarter-inch thick individual stems. I'd be lucky if I get a dozen blueberries all together.
Yeah, you're a bad mother. Now, are they getting full sun?
Yes, they are. They're in the, seems like, I believe, the second half of the day, they're getting plenty of sun.
Oh. To produce fruits, blueberries need a massive amount of sun. They are full sun plants, especially where you are. The further north you go, the more full sun means full sun. They should be getting sun from first thing in the morning to when it sets in the evening. Have you done anything to acidify their soil since you put them in?
No, I haven't. That's what I was going to ask you, because I definitely don't want to go with a chemical.
No. This has nothing to do with chemicals or organics. This is all cultural. Now, when you planted them, how much did you put peat moss in the planting holes?
Yes, I did.
How much?
I believe it was close to like a 50-50 mix with the native soil.
Okay, good. That was a good start.
Yeah.
What you should have been doing over the past several years is every spring, you should have been putting down another inch or two of peat moss and covering that with compost.
Okay.
And making sure they get full sun, making sure they're well watered. You might want to find some device or test strips to measure the soil acidity, because if the roses are doing okay, the soil is not acid enough for the blueberries.
Okay, that's probably the case then.
Yeah, blueberries require a soil. They grow in natural peat bogs in nature. They require a soil so acidic that if you had a little paper cut on your finger and you stuck it into their soil, it should hurt. It should really sting.
Okay.
Some people who don't want to use huge amounts of peat moss or who even despite the peat moss can't get the pH down to 5 or below will use a little elemental sulfur. That's another thing you can use. Sulfur being an element, it's going to take longer to incorporate into the soil, but its acidifying effects will last much longer.
What type of acidity level am I looking for if I get a test kit?
Under 5.
Under 5, okay.
Yes. For instance, neutral is 7. Most garden plants grow best between 6.5 and 7. And it's kind of like decibels. As you go down low, it's not a straight geometric thing. I mean, once you get below 6, it gets harder and harder to get the pH level down. Rhododendrons and azaleas thrive between 5.5 and 6.
As far as the way that the stems are coming up, instead of like one solid one, just, you know, individual very thin ones.
Oh, they're barely alive, man. They're barely alive. I mean, they have been hanging on waiting for you to make this phone call for 3 years.
Yeah,
you know, you got to get that pH down, and they need a lot of sun and a lot of water in a hot year.
Well, and we haven't gotten that in a while. I mean, just in the last, you know, couple hours, we've had some pretty good severe thunderstorms. But it's,
oh no, this is
pretty dry here.
Yes, no, you need to be deeply watering them once a week. Every week we don't get rain.
Okay.
And that's like letting a hose drip at the base of the plants for like 4 or 5 hours.
Okay. Now, it has nothing to do with the fact that I believe these I bought these from like Tennessee, and they were a blue crop.
Well, you bought the wrong ones too.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Right too.
Yeah, you're in the north. Okay. You're where blueberries are native to. You could grow the low-growing true northern blueberries, or you could grow high bush blueberries. If you bought blueberries that were destined for Tennessee, they would be the more heat-tolerant varieties with the fewer chilling hours, like a southern blueberry or a rabbit eye. So unless blue crop is a type of high bush blueberry, you might not even be growing the right variety, but you should buy your plants locally.
Yeah, good point.
They would be more adapted to your area, but you do all the right things, and you're in the perfect climate to grow lots of blueberries.
Okay.
All right, Dan?
Hey, Mike, thank you very much.
Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Louise, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am fine, Louise. How are you?
I'm wonderful.
And where is Louise wonderful?
Well, I'm wonderful in Center City, Philadelphia.
And can we identify the neighborhood a little more tightly?
Yeah, around 13th and Lombard.
Okay, sure. So you're almost a South Streeter.
Well, kind of, sort of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of, sort of, maybe. All right. What can we do for Louise on Lombard?
Well, I was just wondering, since I produce a fair amount of raw organic vegetable scraps,
right,
if I put them in the blender with water and liquefy them, could I use that to water my container plants?
Outside.
Right.
Yes. The simple answer is yes. Not citrus. You would not want to use orange or lemons or limes or anything like that. But there are two problems here. One of which is you're not adding much, if any, nutrition.
That's what I was wondering.
To your plants. The only things that cycle through your kitchen that have plant feeding capabilities are coffee grounds and eggshells. Perhaps tea leaves as well. Tea leaves are tremendously under-researched. But we know, for instance, that of like apple cores and lettuce leaves, there's not a lot of nutrition there. The exception, interestingly enough, would be legumes. It would be string beans and snow peas.
Okay.
But those are also the nitrogen-rich parts are the parts we eat. So if you're like me and you find a bag of string beans in the back of the fridge a month later, that would probably be a good thing to liquefy. And that might have some plant-feeding property to it because these are nitrogen-fixing plants and they tend to hold the nitrogen inside the edible parts. But. You are in the center of Center City. You are actually only about 7 blocks from the geographical center of Center City. And I would worry about vermin.
I'm up on the 13th floor.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I have containers on the balcony that are I've been very lucky this year because of the mild winter. Everything survived. And I have a beautiful container garden, all in terracotta containers.
What
I was wondering. But I was also concerned about drawing, you know, you said vermin, but insects as well, you know, if I would do something like that.
I can't get this image of rats building little siege towers out of my mind.
And basically the insects, they don't make oxygen masks small enough, so I really don't get too much up here.
No, I would imagine your pollination is poor because you're above where bees fly.
Yeah, right. You're right.
But if you have annual flowers or you're going to, like, grow yourself some peppers or squash or something like that, you should get a little artist brush, a little paint brush.
Yeah.
And in the morning, when the flowers are just open, just take the brush from one flower to the other and spread the pollen back and forth.
I've tried that. I've tried that with squash blossoms.
Okay, and that should work.
Yeah.
That should work, because without it, squash being purely insect pollinated, you might have a hard time. Now, I also do want to put in a last-minute bid for you getting a worm bin inside.
See, that's what I'm not interested in.
You don't want to do that. Okay.
And also I thought, you know, that the vegetables probably had to decompose somewhat for them to be beneficial at all. And, you know, just throwing making soup out of them wasn't good enough.
No. I don't think cooking decomposition. If anything, it would be like the raw food diet. Any little bit of nutrients they contain are going to be maximized when they're the freshest.
Right.
So
okay.
If you want to do this, I think being on the 13th floor, it's an absolutely perfect experiment for you to do.
Okay.
And remembering that any legumes, that would be soybeans as well.
Sure.
Soybeans,
sure.
String beans, peas. And for instance, if you do drink coffee,
yeah,
adding a few coffee grounds to every batch, you might be on to something here.
Yeah.
But I don't see any harm in it whatsoever. Other, you know, unless of course you start to notice it's smelling a little bit bad outside, then you'll stop it or back it off, or you'll
right.
need a steady supply of soil or compost to put over top after you pour it in.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, very interesting. It was just a thought, and I thought, well, I'll call and ask and see what the answer would be.
I would play around with it if I were you.
Yeah, I think I will.
All right. Good luck, Louise.
All right, dear. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Rob, how are you, sir?
I'm good.
Where is Rob good?
I'm in Claymont, Delaware.
I know the area well, a very nice part of Delaware. What can we do for Rob?
Yeah, I've got 8 raised beds.
Excellent.
And they're 4x4, and I guess they're probably about 6 inches deep.
Okay.
What I did last year, I bought some mixed soil. It's topsoil, 10% mushroom soil.
Oh, okay.
It worked out really good, but then this year when I went to till,
mm-hmm.
I got all kind of roots.
Now, wait a minute. Why would you ever till a raised bed?
Well, because I just wanted to do it, so I just did it. And just to see if it was loose, but then I seen all these vines going through there like it was vine mushrooms.
Okay. Okay, now, first of all, don't till them again. One of the big benefits of building a raised bed is they don't need to be tilled. Every time you till the soil, you release nutrients and you expose buried weed seeds. So tilling has two negative effects. Now, you say when you tilled these raised beds, you found vines growing
yeah.
throughout the soil. Were they actually plant material, or were they just little white streaks?
Oh, no. They were pretty big, and they smelled like the mushroom soil.
Well, they smelled like the mushroom soil because they were growing in the mushroom
yeah,
soil. Did you pull them out?
Like a lot of them. They were like a light brown, very light brown.
And like as big as a shoelace, bigger?
Bigger than a shoelace.
Bigger than a shoelace. So what's growing,
yeah.
what's growing nearby your raised beds? Do you have trees and shrubs and stuff?
Yeah, but they're behind the fence.
Well, don't forget, Rob, when you look up at a tree or a shrub, the root system goes out at least as far as the furthest branch.
So it could be the shrubs going
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, and that, you know, how was your garden last year?
My garden was good last year. This year, it seemed to be going a little slow. My tomatoes aren't doing very well. My cucumbers, like, going crazy.
Okay. What did you add to the raised beds to increase the nutrients?
Nothing. I just went and got some Miracle-Gro topsoil.
Oh, man. Now, I don't understand how somebody would build raised beds, fill them with a little bit of mushroom soil, and then go to Miracle-Gro. You just non-organic your organic garden. So,
oh, I did?
Yeah. Miracle-Gro is chemical fertilizer. And if it's in potting soil, it's just a trace amount. So you like lost your morality, but you didn't get anything for it. So, you know, it's kind of like a lot of deals we make in life. No, what I want you to do is get some of that mushroom soil or some nice yard waste compost and just put an inch of it on top of your raised beds.
Okay.
A nice fresh inch. And do that every year. Now,
okay.
I don't think the vines are taking any nutrition. If you are worried about it, what I want you to look for is a Japanese gardening knife. These are a little bit pricey. They're not going to be really cheap, but they are very handy tools, and they're exceptionally sharp. And what you could do every year if you were worried about, and I don't think they're vines, I think they're plant roots. You could take this and literally use it like a bayonet. Go around the inside of each raised bed and just slice, and then reach down, and anything that is now loose you could pull out. But I don't think it's going to be a problem unless you see actual plants coming up out of the raised beds.
Yeah, and I like that because it is around the edges.
Yeah, yeah, and you can just go around the edges. You don't have to disturb the soil. And then after you go around the edges with this Japanese gardening knife, you'll never go back once you got one of these. You'll use it for a million things. In the future, the most important thing is you need to put an inch or 2 inches of fresh compost or well-aged mushroom soil on top, because your plants need some nutrition, especially in a hot year like this where things are growing. Yeah. You need more nutrition, but no more tilling. You're going to create more problems than you're going to solve.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
All right, good luck.
I'm going to try that. Thank you.
Good luck, Rob.
All righty.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners having a great season that they can donate their extra produce to help feed hungry families in their area. Many food banks run summertime collection sites, and the ones that don't would love to work something out with you. So contact your local food bank and see exactly how you can get your excess eggplant into the hands of people who need it most. But don't go looking for the food bank locator at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone calls and what to do with that horse's tail in your garden. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
The Hispanic Institute at LaSalle University supports WHYY and announces a new master's program in translation and interpretation that addresses three main environments: business, legal, and healthcare, where translation and interpretation involving English and Spanish is currently needed and will continue to be in the future. Details at 215-951-1100 or lasalle.edu/Hispanic Institute. LaSalle University. Choose LaSalle for your master's in translation and interpretation.
He was an outsider. He challenged the art world by collecting the new masters and giving them a home. More Cézanne than the Louvre, and the world's largest collection of Renoir. Dr. Albert Barnes and his grand experiment in education, the Barnes Collection, the WHYY original production, proud to be part of the PBS Arts Summer Festival. The Barnes Collection, Friday night at 9 on WHYY TV. See a preview at whyy.org/barnes.
86 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia at 1140.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. The weed known as horsetail is one of the most ancient plants on the planet. So ancient, it comprises much of the coal we burn today. But it did not go extinct with the dinosaurs. Instead, it thrives where it is unwanted and it is difficult to remove. We'll tell you what to do if you got horsetail after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Thomas, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there.
Hello, Thomas. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Where is Thomas Great?
Well, I am in the Dothan, Ozark area.
I've been in Dothan, Alabama, right?
Yeah, Dothan, Alabama, the Dothan, Ozark area in Alabama.
I have been in Dothan. What was I doing in Dothan? Do you remember, Thomas? I have been there, yes. I know the area well. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I have a question pertaining to one of my clients. See, I'm a professional lawn care person, and one of my clients has a concrete block shed in their backyard.
Right.
And there's a horrible yellow jacket infestation inside the wall. And my father has come out there and sprayed triazinon.
He's just wasting his time.
Yeah. They just retaliated. They didn't. Yeah. They got him worse than he got them.
Well, being as an unorganic gardener, I won't say anything because it's your dad, but, sooner or later, these poisons are affecting insects less and less. You know, the only thing they're hurting is us right now. And
right. You
think about spraying poisons just kind of randomly. It's kind of a Neanderthal reaction. We should be smarter than they are. And there are a couple of smart ways that a couple of smart guys can use to get rid of yellow jacket nests without using any poisons. There are two very ingenious ways. And I believe our listeners have come up with these over the years. Now, you know the yellow jackets are least aggressive at night. So you have to do all your setup at night. Due to a unique factor in their sight, you can use flashlights if you cover them with red cellophane.
Okay.
They can't see that color spectrum. And obviously, you want to move slowly, and you're hoping for a cool night. But you know these outdoor bug zappers that people have by their pools to theoretically kill mosquitoes?
Yes, I do.
Well, they don't kill mosquitoes. Mosquitoes don't go to them. They tend to kill other insects. But yellow jackets are very aggressive and very territorial. So if you can get one or two of these bug zappers out to the area, run a grounded outlet, from a safe outdoor outlet and extension cords, and ideally hang them somehow on shepherd hooks near where they go in and out of the wall of the shed.
Okay.
They, in the morning, will see this thing, and they will attack it. And, of course, the ones that attack it will be zapped. Well, the entire colony will get in line to leap to their doom inside the frying jaws of this machine.
That's very interesting.
This is a classic way of getting rid of a yellow jacket nest. Again, you have to be very careful during the setup. You're hoping for a cold night. You're moving very slowly. You're not making any noise. And for God's sake, don't turn the machine on until you're safely out of the way.
Yeah,
because they may even come out at night and start attacking it. But within 48 hours, they'll all be dead.
Okay.
The other option is to use a shop vac. If you can get the hose of a shop vac near, I presume there's a doorway where they go in and out all the time, their own little entrance hole.
Yeah, it's just like a crack.
Yes, exactly. If you could, how high off the ground is it?
About 2 feet off the ground.
Well, that's not bad. If you could take a table out there, put the hose of the shop vac on the table, and then have everything set up again, and then in the morning when they start to be active, turn the shop vac on. They will attack the shop vac from the noise it's making and the sucking sound, and they will all be sucked to their doom. And in that, you like both these things, don't you?
I love it. They're genius.
And then other people came up with this. I just have a decent memory. And then after you don't see any more going into the shop vac, you duct tape up the end before you turn off the vacuum. And then you leave it sit out in the sun for a day or two to make sure they're all cooked.
All right.
Those are the safest ways. You're not spraying poisons, and it's more effective. It's a great way to clear out the entire nest, and you can assure your client that that nest will not be reused in future years. They always build new nests.
All right. That's good. I really like that.
Okay, good.
I'll try one, and I might even end up trying both. It just depends.
Okay. Well, good luck, and I'm very confident that either one will work for you.
Okay, great. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, sir.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
I am doing well, Michael. How are you?
I'm excellent today.
And where is Michael excellent?
I am calling from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, just outside of Haddonfield.
Very good. No, Cherry Hill doesn't need to bow to Haddonfield.
Well, they are very large, so to give you a proximity of where I am, since you're familiar with the area, I thought I'd mention that.
We all know Cherry Hill.
Good, good.
Don't you let those Haddonfieldites bully you, sir.
Never.
All right. What can we do for Michael in Cherry Hill, New Jersey?
Well, my question is revolving around aeration. And the reason why is because I have a backyard that is filled with trampling kids constantly, a playground, plus two dogs. And as you know, or I'm sure you know, in Cherry Hill, we have a very compact soil, and if you dig down maybe 4 or 5 inches, it's hard clay in my backyard. So my question to you is, aeration even going to assist with this situation, or should I just completely start over? Should I add soil? Should I lay down mulch over the whole backyard? What would you recommend?
Well, this is a hard summer to ask the question. Normally, I would then ask you, so how does your backyard look? But seeing as we're going into our 18th heat wave of the summer, the summer's only half over, and you apparently have the Justice League and the Avengers having daily battles out there.
Always.
Do you have any green at all?
We do have a little bit, and this has been a thought or a conversation I'd love to have had with you even last year, just because it's been an ongoing issue, and of course, the longer it goes, it just gets more trampled and more. But yes, to answer your question, we do have a little bit of green, but it is a challenging backyard. I'll bet it is.
I may have an oddball solution for you.
Okay.
So what kind of sun and shade?
A little mixture of both. Actually, some decent shade back there.
Well, when you say decent shade, grass doesn't like shade.
Well, a portion of it, and what I've done is I've created some mulched areas where there is shade, so the areas that do receive the sunlight, you know, it's growing, but when that ground is so firm that even through aeration, even through seeding, you know, any sort of rainwater, especially this summer, is just going to run right off it. I mean, we have some decent aeration and some...
So you have aerated in the past?
I have, yes, but...
And what time of year did you aerate?
I did it, well, I guess it was about 4 months ago.
Okay, you aerated at the wrong time of year.
Okay, and perfect. So now guide me to when I should be doing this aeration.
I presume you have a cool season lawn out back. You either have fescue or bluegrass.
A combination of both, yes.
Okay, yes. These are cool season grasses. This is why they look like Hades right now.
Correct.
They were never meant to withstand this kind of heat. You aerated them right before the heat wave starts, which meant you took little chunks out of their bodies, and then it got really hot. And they don't like you for that. The time to aerate a cool season lawn is in the fall, the same time that you would also start over and sow a new lawn, or take the indirect route of feeding the existing lawn with compost to improve the soil structure underneath.
Okay.
So... one option, you would core aerate towards the end of August.
Okay.
And then I would get a big truckload of municipal yard waste compost, spread it over the entire backyard, and overseed it with the same kind of seed that you have out there. The perfect time for seeding a cool season lawn in the Northeast is between August 15th and September 15th.
Gotcha.
But you could grow zoysia grass out there. That's a warm season grass you would install in the spring. I think it is the grass that would take the dogs and the kids best, but it would turn tan and dormant over the winter, and I don't know how you feel about
that. No, I've seen that. I'm familiar with that. I would have no problem if it could handle, because it's a very thick and hardy grass.
No, there's no weeds. The dogs wouldn't tear it up. The kids wouldn't harm it. It grows very slowly. All the other girls like it. It makes its own clothes.
Well, it sounds like that may be a better opportunity.
So in the spring, rather than aerate, you would till everything up, rake away as much of the green as you could, put down that inch of yard waste compost, and then install your zoysia grass plugs. The more zoysia plugs you buy, the faster it will fill in. If you buy twice as many plugs as they say you need for your square acreage, it will fill in twice as fast. But no matter what, even with the kids and dogs having some time out there, you'll need to restrict it a little bit. Certainly by the end of the summer, it'll be a solid carpet. And from that point on, it'll be invulnerable to their tender mercies. It will simply go tan and dormant over the winter.
Well, it's already brown now just because it looks like dirt.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is you'll have a beautiful green lawn in the summer.
Exactly. I think that's well worth it.
All right, and it gives you time to plan.
Yeah.
Okay?
Thank you very much, Mike.
All right, good luck, sir. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Horsetail, the weed that shines your pots and pans. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, who has her voice back this week. Read this week's question, s'il vous plaît.
Absolutely. Sally in Coastal Maine writes, I've been an organic gardener since before you started editing Organic Gardening magazine.
That would be back in 1990.
But now I'm so bothered by a weed called horsetail that I'm thinking about giving up gardening. I have already mowed over my perennial garden because of this weed and sifted the roots out of the soil by hand. Not easy for a lady approaching 70. Now that my new plants are in, I go out daily and pull, pull, pull. This weed is the worst I've ever dealt with. It spreads underground and via spores. I have read that I might be able to get rid of it if I solarize my soil for one summer. But I have a beautiful, productive asparagus patch, as well as rhubarb and blueberries in the area. I went to my extension service for advice. They have the same problem in one of their gardens. I've tried cardboard, newspaper, and multiple types of deep mulch without any luck. And this weed seems to love weed block, sending out its invasive roots along the edges and poking through the fabric in less than one season. I garden in cool USDA Zone 5 and have a nice sandy loam soil supplemented annually with homemade compost and purchased lobster compost. I use liquid fish fertilizer when needed and water deeply and infrequently. If you have any ideas about how to get rid of horsetail, I would really love to hear them. Thank you.
Well, you can probably forget solarization no matter what, Sal. Utilizing the power of the sun is a great way to destroy weeds and diseases in soil. But as you note, you have to let the area bake under clear plastic for an entire summer to achieve success. And your far north region might not have enough of a summer to do the trick. Solarization works best in areas that receive a solid 3 months of hot and sunny weather. Now, before we proceed to try and destroy it, let us first faintly praise this living fossil that is among the oldest plants in the world. How old is it? So old that much of the coal we burn today was once horsetail. The plant contains such large amounts of silica that it has served as a kind of natural sandpaper for millennia. Some gardeners deliberately grow it next to their bird bath so they can use the gritty plant to clean the saucer between fillings. And it's better than Brillo at scrubbing pots and pans. It's also attractive enough, kind of like a little miniature pine tree, that it's been deliberately planted as an ornamental. And the people who did so probably felt pretty good about the decision the first couple of years, as it's very slow to establish. But when it does get going, you better have wanted to become a horsetail farmer. Like the equally invasive running bamboo, individual shoots come up from a massive underground root system. And so one of the ways to slowly get rid of it is to continually cut the new plants as they appear, weakening the root. It's vitally important to recognize and destroy the fertile stems that appear in the spring. Left undisturbed, the cone-like structures that appear at the top will disperse a mass of spores. Oh, and you can forget spraying this plant away at any stage. Horsetail is incredibly resistant to herbicide attack. Now, if I were around 70 years old, I'd probably be comfortable sitting on an overturned milk crate and pruning those fertile stems as they appear. But for the season-long grind of constant culling, I'd probably hire a couple neighborhood kids for a few hours a day, a few days a week. Teach them to soak the soil around the plants, then slide a trowel underneath each plant and lift it out slowly, being careful to keep as much of the underground rhizome attached to the plant as possible. If they can master the art of slowly lifting up large root systems, they should be able to clear good-sized sections for you. When an area is clear, mulch it with something like 6 inches of wood chips for a year. It should be safe to replant the area after that. Now, the blueberries, make sure the soil around them is as acidic as you can manage. Saturate the area with peat moss and add sulfur to bring the pH down under 5. The blueberries will love it, but I suspect the horsetail will suffer. Same in the asparagus bed. Get the pH down to 6. Asparagus takes an acid soil. And dust the bed with rock salt over the winter. This is typically done with asparagus to prevent disease, but in this case we're hoping it harasses the horsetail. And finally, horsetail thrives in wet soil. So try not to add any water to your garden. In your climate, you shouldn't have to water most years. And if any areas it's infesting hold water or drain poorly, consider core aeration with a machine that pulls plugs out of the soil. The better your soil drains, the less the horsetail will like it. Well, that sure was a lot of depressing information for people who got horsetail now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over carefully and plan your best line of attack. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to scrub me down with silica if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line and check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution, hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. You Bet Your Garden is now on Facebook. Please visit our page and tell us what you think. Elizabeth Perez Lunes, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Bob Alls. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. Our social media director is Facebook savvy Amanda McGrath. Heavily friended Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Approaching 1,000 friends is our production assistant Kelly Haggerty. Our esteemed editor Al Banks has friends in India and Omaha. I'm still using a rotary phone, Mike McGrath. Otherwise, I'd have a million friends. No, a billion. I'd have special friends, friendly friends. Well, I would. Darn this old dialogue. Anyway, I do hope you'll like us on Facebook so I can see you again next week. What can you do when homegrown tomatoes are failures in flavor? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll look at the potential causes of tasteless tomatoes and reveal some last-minute tricks you can try to induce a flavor boost, plus your fabulous phone calls.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, a seasoned media manipulator tells us how it's done and swears that he's reformed.